Oh my God, Becky, look at that pack. The curve is so low. It looks like a constructed legacy deck. Who understands those cube designers anyway? They only play cheap cards because they don't want to get blown out by five drops. I mean, the curve, it's just so low. I can't believe it's so lean. It's like really low. Gross. Look, the game is just so small.
My anaconda don't want none unless you got
a Bun Magic Cube.
Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Great. Well, then hello and welcome. Brand new. Sadie, no. Sadie, no. Literally, no. We literally just started. The hello was to the audience, not to a person in your home. Anyway, welcome to an episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy. I am here, as always, with my host, Anthony. Maddox.
Oh, on not even just.
That's right.
Can we tell people that? Is that a secret?
Great question. Maybe I'll bleep the whole thing. But people will know the secret within a couple of weeks. Let's put it that way.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we dive in, Anthony, we got to say that we have something fun to announce. It's our first ever product slash... Does this qualify as merch? Probably not merch.
No, it's not merch. It's art.
There you go. It's art. We have produced, in collaboration with the organizers of KubeCon and with the help of all of the many designers of all the featured cubes at KubeCon, a print of the cube map with all of the KubeCon cubes labeled. It's a nice 18 by 24 inch archival quality print that we're selling. So if you're going to be at KubeCon, you can buy one. We are not doing shipping, unfortunately. So to most of you listening who are not going to be at KubeCon, I'm sorry this product is not available to you. Unless you have like a friend going to KubeCon and you're willing to have them pick it up for you. But we're just delivering them in person at the event in Madison. So if you're going to be in attendance, check it out. It'll be linked in the show notes. And it's our like baby step into maybe making physical stuff. And I think your calling it art was prescient, Anthony, because importantly in the past, we have mentioned that we don't really want to make merch in the sense of like putting our logo on a playmat or whatever and just calling it a day. No disrespect to anybody that does do that. That's just not what we would want to do if we were going to like make stuff. If we're going to make stuff, we want to like make something unique and special and worthy of existing, even absent its connection to us in the show. And that's what this is. Really proud of this.
Yeah, I mean, we are the weirdos here that are not really trying to build a brand. We're just using this whole podcast and website and things as a creative outlet. And I mean, the Cube Map has just been a really fun project to work on. Big, big credit is owed, obviously, to Jet for actually making the whole project happen. But for me, doing all the technical stuff, it's also been cool to watch it, you know, grow and evolve. And actually being able to just sort of see all kinds of different cubes that are going to be featured at the event labeled in this space is pretty a cool thing to see.
And I got to design a poster, which I haven't done in probably 15 years, but used to be a big part of what I did.
Nice.
For fun.
Feels like we're back in art school.
Back in college,
making
baby.
Stuff in your basement.
It's true. So yeah, check it out if you're going to be attending KubeCon. It's going to be $50. We're not making much money on these things. I mean, so far...
We might make less than money.
We might make negative money. I really hope we break even. We have to sell 39 to break even. And so far, we've sold 14. I'm dropping the numbers on the episode.
14. Cool.
It's only been for sale for a couple days. So, you know, I'm really hoping to break even. I'd feel great if we broke even. If we sold one more than breaking even, we'd make like $20. That would be great. I'd be very happy with that. Mostly, it's just a cool excuse to get to make these things and hopefully get them in people's hands. I'm really excited to have it just hanging on my own wall as a cool souvenir from KubeCon.
Yeah, I've already reached my one art per wall limit in my house.
You're going to start doubling up. Yeah, we have different approaches to that as we sit in my room with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things on the wall in this tiny room, plus a shelf with four more
frame
things
on it.
Okay,
yeah, you have you're better at art.
No, I have more in my life, I think is what it is. Just I've accumulated more stuff. And these posters are a pre-order only, so you can't buy them at the event. You have to buy them ahead of time and then pick it up at the event. So if you want one, make sure you order one, because I don't want anyone that wants one to not get one. So check out the link in the show notes. That's enough shameless shilling, but we are talking about a KubeCon-related topic on this week's show. My own Bun Magic Cube is going to be featured at KubeCon this year, and those that have been listening to the show for a year or more will remember that last year leading up to KubeCon, we did strategic episodes to talk about how to draft Anthony's two feature cubes that were at KubeCon last year. Both those cubes are back at KubeCon again this year. And it was basically just primers for people that were planning on drafting the KubeCon to help them approach that draft and feel confident going into their first pack one, pick one, and know what the environment was about. I also think these episodes are an interesting perspective on a cube as a player, which we're so often talking about cube as designers. And so it's fun to get to put that hat aside for a moment and just purely focus on how are we going to draft this environment with a focus on just trying to rack up wins, basically. So this episode is going to be that, but for the Bun Magic Cube, I think at some point we should talk about the like more substantial changes that have been made to the regular cube and turbo cube. But I think the episodes we did last year probably still hold up for those cubes, more or less.
Yeah, I think overall, if you just go back and listen to those, you'll have a pretty good baseline just sort of what those environments are really all about. There have been some minor changes and some maybe some new strategies that weren't there previously. But for the most part, I think all those changes still fit very much in line with the spirit of the cube. So it won't be like big surprises.
I really like that one of the like key cards we talked about last year in the regular cube was Feather, the Redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the flagship for this whole like red white heroic combat tricks powers matter like style of archetype. And you've since cut Feather, but the draft after you cut Feather, the deck that won was basically just a Feather deck that just didn't have Feather. It was so clear to me that like that deck has been codified in this environment because of Feather. I think if Feather wasn't in the cube initially, people would not feel as strongly about this deck as they do now. But because Feather was such a clear signpost to get you into that deck, now you just kind of like quietly removed it, and if people aren't paying attention, they still just draft that deck and have huge success with it. That deck 3-0'd immediately the draft after you took Feather out.
People finally have started playing Annex and Cymeed, and that card does a lot.
I just like that it's like the ghost of Feather will haunt this cube for a while. Just people will keep drafting that deck for a long time. It says a lot about the power of a signpost card to get people to change their perspective on a draft and open up a lane that was already open. Like, you could have drafted that deck already without Feather. It's just that most people didn't. And now people know to because they're familiar with the deck now. Anyway, so all by way of saying, that deck still exists in the regular cube. You can't draft Feather anymore, but that deck is still very much there, and you can still have a lot of success with it. So yeah, if you're going to be at KubeCon, check out those episodes from last year. We'll probably do some follow-up either on this episode or another episode to talk about some of the more substantial changes that have happened to each of those environments. But this episode is all about the Bun Magic Cube, Anthony.
You pointed at a different cube.
I did.
That affects people who are listening, but it was weird for me.
There's cubes everywhere.
Please point at the correct cube.
Well, it's in a different box now because I had to get a special travel box.
Oh, that's a special travel box. Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, I love my big wooden box, but it is not good for travel.
It's not good for travel.
It weighs 500 pounds, and I'm worried about the box getting damaged if it's like being banged around and stuff. So I just got like a regular old box to keep it.
You didn't
want to
just get some cardboard long boxes?
No.
Okay. Wow.
That is one way in which we're different. No, I don't want to put in cardboard long boxes.
It's going to be at the event.
Anyway, my Bun Magic Cube. We've talked about it a lot on the show, but I will take this conversation from the top on the presumption that maybe some people that have never listened to the show before will listen to this episode in order to prepare for drafting this cube at KubeCon. Maybe that'll happen. That'd be cool if it did. This is my Eternal Cube. I call it an Eternal Cube because there's plenty of cards in this cube that are banned in Legacy, but calling it a Vintage Cube comes with a lot of additional baggage. People expect things like power and particular strategies to be supported that are not supported, but it is an Eternal Cube, so it's pulling from the full history of Magic. I don't restrict myself on what cards I can play, and it's a very powerful cube. This started as being inspired by the Magic Online Vintage Cube, specifically matches I had watched LSV play on YouTube years and years ago and just wanted to have a similar kind of experience in our own playgroup. And so I cobbled together the first version of it, trying to pursue those peaks of power, but with, you know, whatever cards I happen to have on hand. And it's been evolving for the past 6 years since then. What it represents now, today, is a very lean, low-to-the-ground, low-curving, fair environment. Fair is kind of subjective, but for me, what fair means is that all of the cards in the cube are going to play on the same axes, and you're going to have to care about tempo and value in basically every game you're playing. What I mean is, like, I don't include things like Splinter Twin combo, which I would call unfair, and the reason I consider it unfair is because if you do a Splinter Twin combo on turn 5, it literally doesn't matter what happened in the entire game prior. It doesn't matter how much tempo you accrued or how much tempo you lost or how much value you accrued or value you lost, because this infinite combo just negates all of that stuff as soon as it happens, right? The same can be said of like a reanimator strategy, right? Similar kind of thing where if you just like cheat a giant creature out into play, who cares if you went way down on value and like, you know, 4-for-1 yourself to put Grizzlebrand in play because now you have this like thing that kind of just breaks the fundamental rules of the game, right? It breaks this like progression from low resources to high resources as the game goes on and just kind of ignores these abstract axes you have to care about. So
yeah, I mean, not breaks rules in terms of the literal rules of the game, but right. Breaks these sort of expectations of the flow of a game.
Right. Expectations like, oh, I expect my Lightning Bolt to be able to kill anything my opponent puts into play on turn one or turn two. Reanimating Grizzlebrand really kind of upsets all his expectations. And so there's none of that stuff supported. None of those unfair strategies.
And sneak attack and show and tell are probably things you'd also put in there. And tinker.
Yeah, anything that cheats mana costs is not included. You can generate additional mana. There is some ramp, but there is nothing that just ignores mana costs. And we'll get to why there is some potential.
Except for Treasure Cruise?
Well, no, I wouldn't call that cheating mana. You have to pay for it different. We wouldn't call something that had Convoke cheating mana, would you? You're thinking about it.
A little bit.
you might consider a Convoke spell to be cheating mana.
I don't know. Sprout Swarm, it doesn't feel like fair magic, which is what we're talking about.
No, I would actually say that Sprout Swarm feels quintessentially fair. It's just incredibly dumb.
Okay.
It's dumb how fair it is, right? Because you're like, well, this is not unfair. You're paying 5 mana for a 1/1, but I just can't
ever win. But are you paying 5 mana?
Basically, yeah, okay. I think so. It's never really efficient, even if you're tapping 5 creatures to make a 1/1. It's just that it's frustrating, I think, because it is a fair strategy that a lot of decks just can't beat. And that's what makes it so frustrating. Like, if Sprout Swarm was really unfair, it would just be like a combo. And you'd be like, oh, you Squirrel Nest Earthcrafted me. But it's not. It's like, you're just making 1/1s. It's fair, but I still can't win, and I'm very frustrated by it.
Well, sorry to bring that up.
This cube is also exactly 360 cards, so most of you, if you have a chance to draft it at KubeCon, will be in a full pot of 8, which means you'll see every card in the entire cube. I love designing cubes that have no additional cards, where you draft the entire pool every time you sit down, because it gives me as a designer total control over the experience. I'm not giving up anything to variance of what's opened and what's not opened, and so that's an important part of the cube's ethos, too, to kind of play at this razor's edge of super efficient, super fair, powerful magic, and keeping it to exactly 360 means that I can stay as close to that razor's edge as I want. I'm not giving up any equity on, you know, randomness, basically, for what is opened or what is not opened. I was thinking the best way to do this, Anthony. I think there's a couple ways to go about it. First, I want to talk about how this cube differs from other cubes people might be familiar with, and I just want to basically talk about how this cube differs from like the Magic Online Vintage Cube, which is probably the cube most people know, have seen played before, maybe have played themselves. And if you are familiar with that cube and you come to my cube, you will see a lot of familiar cards.
It does really look very similar superficially. It's like, oh yeah, we got Counterspell, we got Lightning Bolt, we got Llanowar Elves, and then we have, you know, some of the big scary threats like Murktide Regent. Other things have been printed more recently that are definitely big features of those kinds of cubes.
Yeah, I haven't looked, but I would guess probably 80 or 90% of my cube is or has been at some point in the Magic Online Vintage Cube. I don't think there's many cards I'm playing that have never been in that cube before.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe a better way to put it is no card here is going to be an unfamiliar card. If you are a person who's been playing a lot of Magic, a lot of high-powered Magic, you will have seen pretty much everything here.
Yeah. And I think when people come to a cube list and they see those powerful cards, they might start to assume, okay, well, this is like other powerful cubes that I've played. And in reality, this cube is very, very different from the Magic Online Vintage Cube. And the ways in which it's different are that it is extremely low curving and that it is fair. Those are the two biggest differences. So I think oftentimes the Magic Online Vintage Cube, the games and decks are defined by the unfair thing they're doing. You've drafted a Storm deck, you've drafted a Tinker deck, you've drafted a Reanimator deck, and even though that deck might only have, I don't know, 6 or 7 cards in it that make it a Reanimator deck as opposed to like a blue-black control deck or whatever, those 6 cards have a outsized impact on the texture of that game and how that deck actually feels. So again, even though that deck might have a lot of overlap with in terms of the cards of a deck in my cube, the gameplay is going to be very different because you are never dealing with that sort of unfair stuff.
Yeah, and that also affects the fair decks in that environment as well. Obviously, you know, you can still draft very good aggressive mono white or mono red decks in that environment, but they are very much going to be positioned against trying to beat those strategies.
Yeah, for sure. So I think if you're coming to the Bun Magic Cube from a perspective of the Magic Online Vintage Cube, the biggest tips I would give you in terms of like heuristics to like change your evaluations are basically assume that every single one of your opponents is going to be playing, what is the equivalent of an aggro deck in the Magic Online Vintage Cube? Like, you have to operate on the assumption. Now, there's plenty of control decks and, like, big mid-range decks in my cube, but in a pot of eight, probably five or six of the decks that are going to be drafted are going to, in their speed and efficiency, resemble a very good aggressive deck for the Magic Online Vintage Cube. Whereas, if you're playing the Magic Online Vintage Cube, I've seen people draft that cube and be like, well, I hope I don't run into mono red or mono white, because if I do, my deck's going to lose. If you draft a deck that's going to lose against mono white or mono red in the Magic Online Cube, you will lose most of your matches in a draft of my cube, because there are so many decks that are aggressive and fast, like those occasional decks are in that particular cube. The other thing I would say, just from a heuristic standpoint, is take all of the high mana value cards, and by high I mean anything four and above, and reevaluate it very strongly against how good is this if my opponent is super aggressive and got off to a fast start, and I'm hoping that my four or five or six drop is going to help me clean up, turn the corner, change the tide of the race, because it's just a lot more time in the Magic Online Vintage Cube to set up, to dirtle around for a while, and find the powerful thing to do. In this cube, you just don't have time, and so your high mana value spells have to really clear a high bar for inclusion in your deck, a much higher bar than they do in the Magic Online Vintage Cube.
Another way that factors in is in the kinds of interaction that's relevant. I mean, you mentioned Lightning Bolt killing most things on turn one and two. Lightning Bolt actually just kills most things in this environment.
Yeah, a lot.
And that goes even further for things like Disfigure and spells that you otherwise might overlook, because it seems like they just don't do that much, or they're just for removing that one small threat. But here, they're pretty relevant removal spells.
Yeah, the Disfigures and Shocks of the World, which would be widely unappealing in the Magic Online Vintage Cube, because not every deck is even a creature deck in that cube. The control decks in this cube can have very, very few creatures, but still you're mostly expecting to have more decks playing to the board because there's less unfair strategies going on. But yeah, all the Disfigures and Shocks are all quite good. They're all very effective in this cube and remove a huge chunk of the threats. So yeah, if you're coming from the Magic Online Vintage Cube, those are the two big things. We're going to talk about the mana base of this cube in a little bit later, because that's a more broad topic. That's another way in which this cube is different and might affect your draft. But I think the biggest things are, just assume all of your opponents are going to be, like, maybe a better way to put it is, your deck should have a turn one plan. You should have something you're planning on doing on the first or second turn of the game in every deck. Whereas I see a lot of people draft decks online where it's like, my deck doesn't really do much till turn four or five, but then it really pops off. That's not an option here. You will get blown out of the water. The other perspective I can imagine some people coming to this cube from is not having played the Magic Online Vintage Cube, or maybe any other cubes before, right? If you're coming from a perspective mostly of, like, retail limited, then I think the main difference of drafting a cube like the Bun Magic Cube versus retail limited is coming into the draft with a plan, or at least as the draft is developing, having a very clear plan. In most retail limited environments, you can kind of get by taking good cards in open colors and just kind of following that and seeing what comes together. I have not playing a lot of retail limited these days, so I'm not going to have any, like, recent examples to pull, but that's a lot of what retail limited is. It's like figuring out what's open so you have a chance of getting past really good cards in packs 2 and 3, and then having good card evaluation to figure out which cards in the packs are good versus which are bad. In this cube, all the cards on color are going to be good, right? That's true of a lot of cubes, but a lot of cube designers really try and have a narrow power level band, and I don't strive for a fully flat power level band, but it's definitely a lot narrower than retail limited. So you can't just get by on knowing which cards are good or bad. And if you just kind of cobble together decent cards in two colors in this cube, you will not do anywhere near as well as if you actually have a clear, defined strategy. And that strategy is going to be somewhere on that aggro mid-range control spectrum. You should have a sense of, I am an aggro deck, and because I am an aggro deck, I'm not going to take this Ironcrag Pyromancer, because even though it's a good card in isolation, even though I have four or five ways to trigger it, it's not really on strategy for me to play a 3-mana 0/4 in my deck. I would just rather have Lava Dart, even though it's, you know, less impactful. It only does 2 damage total. I just want that because it gives me more stuff to do early, and I'm planning on being aggressive. Or if you're a control deck, you know, understanding that, yes, you need that Disfigure more than you need that second Planeswalker, right? The Planeswalker might be really good in a vacuum, but again, expect all of your opponents to be playing the equivalent of, like, aggro, and understand that you'll need cheap interaction to remove those aggressive threats to buy you time to get to actually do your strategy. If you don't have those things, you're just going to be dead before you get to activate your Planeswalkers anyway.
Yeah, I think the thing that can happen if you're coming from limited to cube, that is exactly what I did, is you end up just drafting, like, green-black the first time very consistently because you're used to the heuristics of, I'm going to take efficient removal and efficient threats, and that's where you're going to see a lot of those. And that kind of deck just really struggles because you can't necessarily just trade a few removal spells and then play one big threat. That's just not necessarily a strategy that's going to work compared to the things that are much more synergistic and actually get more than the sum of their cards out of it.
Yeah, which is not to say, I think green-black is quite good in this cube. It can be viable, but it's not just a good cards deck. It's
right.
Usually a deck that has a very clear the rock or mid-rangey strategy that is leveraging two-for-one removal and efficient threats like Tarmogoyf and stuff. You have to understand which cards the green-black deck wants that the green-blue deck doesn't want, right? Like where these decks overlap. And that's going to come with time, right? The first time you draft a cube like this, you're not going to be that familiar with it, but I might try and publish some 3-0 or 2-1 deck lists from this cube somewhere just so there's a like repository people can look at to see kind of what decks are successful. But more or less, I think it's just about being committal and having a strategy when you are in the draft instead of just taking quote-unquote good cards. Like, you need to think about the distribution of threats and removal in your deck more than you need to think about just having the best cards in your colors. That's much more important in an environment like this than it is in Retail Limited. In Retail Limited, you end up with kind of the removal density that the packs give you, more or less, right? I don't think it's very often correct to pass the A-minus gold uncommon in your colors to play a D-plus removal spell because you just need more removal, quote-unquote. Whereas the equivalent thing, I think, is often right in the Bun Magic Cube because, again, there's a much smaller delta between the cards, and sure, even if that 4-mana win condition seems appealing, what you actually need is very often some kind of replaceable bread-and-butter effect at a lower mana value to make your deck tick. Let's talk about the mana base in this cube. I think this is a place where people that have not drafted this cube or a cube very similar to it can often get tripped up. I have a ton of fixing in this cube. 82 of my 360 cards are lands. A fair few of those are not fixing lands, so I also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. So I have 62 fixing lands currently and 20 utility lands, which is a much higher percentage than the Magic Online Vintage Cube and then most cubes on Cube Cobra and out there in the world. The fixing I run is also primarily fetch lands and shock lands, both of which I break Singleton for. It's the only cards I do break Singleton for in this cube. I have two cycles of every fetch land and also one Prismatic Vista. More and more, I start to feel like that one Prismatic Vista is kind of an odd card to include in the cube. Like, it's the kind of card that makes a lot of sense if you're sticking to Singleton, but as soon as you're breaking Singleton on fetch, it's like, why do you have this one weird one here? Anyway, I technically have 21 fetch lands because the one Prismatic Vista. And then there are three copies of every shock land.
So just to be super clear, you have two of each fetch land, all 10 of those fetch lands. So 20 in total and 30 shock lands.
Yeah, so 50 of those 62 fixing lands are either fetches or shocks. And the rest are horizon lands or bicycle lands or creature lands from different sets, all in various mixtures.
Which is pretty high. I mean, compared to a lot of cubes that run between 0 and 10%, this is 17% land. So in any given pack, you're going to see between 2 and 3 lands.
Yeah, that's very common. Or even more if you happen to open a pack that just has more in them. I think a lot of people look at this land density and assume more lands means that multicolored decks are better. And I think that's a fallacy, frankly. I think it's just a fallacy of draft that people think that the more lands there are, the easier it is to be a multicolored deck. Especially if you have enough fetch lands like I do, the increase in fixing just means that everybody's mana base is better, right? The only deck that's not affected by running an increased density of fixing is monocolored decks. And I actually don't think almost any monocolored decks are particularly viable here. Mono red and mono white sometimes can get there, and I've seen some people try mono green before, but I actually think in this cube you very rarely end up monocolored because the advantages conferred by that in a cube like the Magic Online Vintage Cube are just not present here. Andy from the editing booth here. I just want to clarify what I mean by this point. I think in the Magic Online Vintage Cube and most cubes with the kind of density of fixing like that cube, you get a huge benefit from playing a monocolored deck because your mana base is perfect. You just always have the right mana and you don't ever stumble on it. And in this cube, because there is so much fixing, you can have just as safe a mana base at 2 and even 3 colors as a monocolored deck does at 1 color. So that benefit of having a perfect mana base is lost, and you're just not running good cards in other colors you could be running. So I think that's the dynamic at play here. But so every deck, the 2-color decks, 3-color decks, and the 4 and more color decks, they're all getting better for a higher density of fixing, right? That's just universal across all the decks in the entire draft. It does not make the many color decks necessarily better. And in this environment specifically, given that I've included 3 copies of every Shockland and there are no original duels here, means that playing a 3 or 4 color deck means you can expect to take a ton of damage from your mana base. Just, you know, expect over the course of the game to take somewhere between 6 and 8 damage from your mana base in almost every game.
Oh, I can do a lot better than that. I've definitely done a lot more. 18, maybe the full 20 once or twice.
I've definitely done a lot more. But as a baseline, like, no matter what, you should assume you're going to take about that much damage from your mana base. And, right, this is always a choice you're making, right? You can choose as a player to play fewer fixing lands in your 3-color deck or to fetch your shock lands in tapped so you don't take 2 damage from them. But you'll find that with the efficiency of the environment, you stand to lose more by playing a less consistent mana base or playing a slower mana base in exchange for that life. So you'll find yourself making the calculation, even though you know it's a relatively fast cube and your life total matters, you're still going to be shocking in lands, fetching and shocking, because it's better to remove that thing now than it is to let it hit you one more turn and bring in your tap land, because you want to just save the life from that thing attacking you and have your mana available next turn instead of having already committed it to some removal spell. Because of that, I actually think, if anything, the like 4 and 5 color decks especially can really struggle here, because you are going to lose a lot of life to your mana base, and you need to have a concrete plan against more aggressive decks. And that's by design. I mean, I am biased. I'm obviously the designer of this cube. I think it is relatively in balance, which is to say that I think you can draft 4 and 5 color decks. I think they are not optimal. Like, it's not like you should do it every single time, but you definitely can draft a really good 4 and 5 color deck. You know, if Sam Black drafts this cube at KubeCon, I fully expect Sam Black to draft a 4 or 5 color deck, and I expect it'll be great, and that's definitely possible. It's a possibility, but it is definitely not like, oh, because of all this fixing, you should do this every single time you sit down.
Yeah, I mean, I think the really critical thing that is just putting pressure on the other side of that scale is the speed of the format and the fact that you're not rewarded for having a lot of fixing in the same way you would be if you just had more time to actually use that fixing. And also the fact that there aren't necessarily huge, huge power outliers, so that by playing a 4-color deck, you're not necessarily just playing like all the best cards because you have access to a larger pool. Those cards really do sort of depend on more synergistic strategies, which means actually just staying in a more focused lane is going to pay you off better.
One set of cards I really don't like from a cube design perspective is the cards that are basically just payoffs for being a 4 or 5 color deck. I run one of those you could describe that way, and that's Golos, but that's largely in there because you could also do other stuff with Golos. You don't have to be playing a 5-color deck for Golos to be good. But when it comes to cards like 4-color Omnath or like Niv-Mizzet, these cards that I see in cubes sometimes, I mean, obviously, everyone do what you want with your own cubes, but I don't like them for my cube because I feel like they're just free payoffs for being the 4 or 5 color deck. And I actually think the 4 or 5 color deck can be really fun to draft, but I really like it when you're kind of cobbling together a strategy out of cards meant for other decks, and you're like taking a bunch of fixing so you can afford to drive a little bit sideways across the intended archetypes of the cube and combine things in unexpected ways. I don't love it as much when you're just like, oh, I drafted fixing really highly, now I get this like these free bombs that are just like incredible that no one else can cast. That's not what this cube supports. So most decks in this cube are going to be 2 or 3 colors. I think 2 and a splash is probably the most common thing we see. Regular, like, straight up and down 2-color decks are also quite common. And then we see fully 3-color decks sometimes. And 4 and 5-color decks do come together, but they need to come together with the understanding that you will be under pressure from almost all of your opponents from the earliest turns in the game, and how are you going to stem the bleeding from what is going to be a pretty painful mana base if you are going to actually make this greedy deck come together. You got to work for it in this cube if you want to be greedy.
Do you also see, in addition to sort of like those kind of more straightforward structures, more nuanced like splashing? Like I'm thinking of decks that maybe are playing things like Territorial Kavu and things like that that have Domain. Do you have like a base green red deck that's splashing a little bit of everything else?
Yeah, I think a lot of the splashing comes from, I think you and I both really like the kind of soft splash cards where you don't have to be in another color to play them, but they get a lot better if you have more colors. Kavu is a great example. I think Prismatic Ending is one of the best examples in this cube. Like I will often splash because I have Prismatic Ending, and then once I'm committed to drafting lands to make Prismatic Ending better and playing them in my deck, it's like, well, I can also probably squeeze a couple black cards in this blue-white deck. That's often a culprit for me stretching a little bit. So there are a bunch of cards like that that I think encourage those kinds of splashes, where you will not have any basics of your splash color. Like, I think that's kind of the line where I consider it a splash. If you have no basics of your third color, that's a splash, and you're kind of getting it for free, because presumably every single one of you are non-basics, taps for at least one of your colors, and also maybe this splash color. And that is a pretty common type of deck that is successful in this environment.
That's another good question, just about the drafting with this much mana fixing in the cube. It does average about 7 or 8 land cards per player, so most people are just going to end up with a ton of non-basic lands in their pool. Does that change the way that you draft and build your deck?
I can only give you my answer on this. I can't give you what is, like, objectively correct, because I just don't know.
I mean, I think we can just put that caveat for all of this, right?
Well, sure. I mean, I know objectively that successful decks tend to be 2 and 3 color. That's a fact I can observe, right? I can't tell you that I have observed other people's drafts in the aggregate and, like, have a good answer for this abstractly. I don't prioritize fixing any less in this environment than I do in an environment with half as much fixing. I will still very happily first pick a fetch land, and I prioritize a shock land in my colors very, very highly once I know I'm in those colors, because that then turns on all of my previous and later picked fetch lands to make them actually fix for my colors. I remember when John's Cultic Cube was on MTGO, I watched some streamers play that cube, and there were a lot of people that were like, oh, fixing is just free here. I never have to take it because there's so much of it. And the Cultic Cube, I think, ran, I think, still even less by percentage, but a pretty close to my density of fixing, and also broke Singleton on fetches and fetchables. And I think that is wrong. I'll just say it. I think I've seen players sit down and draft my cube for the first time and assume they don't have to take lands, and then get to the end and be like, I thought I didn't have to take lands, but I never saw them, you know, in the second half of any pack, and now I just don't have a good mana base. I mean, this is true of everything, but this really, I think, is going to depend on the pod.
Yeah, I think this is one of those difficult things.
It's really difficult.
If everybody's on the same page of, we're just not going to take lands that highly, then everybody's going to get them late. So it's sort of just this, like, weird arms race that can happen. And I feel like we see this in face-up rotisserie drafts all the time, where it's like, once everybody can clearly see the signal of where are people taking the mana fixing, everybody has to get on board, or you're just going to get hosed. But when it's a mixed pod and you haven't played with these people before, it could kind of go either way.
Which technically could be true for any card type, right? Like, everyone agree that removal's not important. You can just get removal for free. And if all 8 players have that mentality that I'm going to get removal pick 10, then you will, because no one's going to take it before pick 10. It's just that I think with lands, it's more obvious, because that's the card that every deck is going to want. Every deck is going to want some amount of fixing. You can't really say every deck's going to want the same kind of removal spells or the same kind of threats or whatever. So I think that's where we see it most obviously. But, like, that is that fundamental tension. That's drafting. Like, knowing when they're going to go is what drafting is. And I've drafted this cube a zillion times, and I know from tracking my games in the beginning half of this year that I actually do have a very winning record in this cube. It was the cube I had the best record in of any cube I drafted more than once, I think, in that period where I was tracking my drafts. It's hard to see sometimes because I don't often 3-0, I think, and I'm always like, oh, I should trophy more of my own cube, and I don't trophy that often. But my overall win record was pretty good in this cube because it's mine. I mean, I hope it is. I know the cube very well, and I don't take fixing any less highly than I do anywhere else. The one caveat to that I'll say is that once I have a shock land in each of my colors, and I know these are the colors that I'm playing, I prioritize the second and third one quite a bit less. I really want to turn on all my fetches, and beyond that, I don't prioritize having the second, third as highly. Sometimes I question running 3 of each shock land. I'm like, is this too many? Like, is this just making it too easy and, like, guaranteed that you get your mana? But I have had, I don't know, I can think in the past year of, like, 3 drafts where I found my lane in pack 1. I was like, I'm going to be Is It? And I literally never saw a Steam Vents. Just never saw one. It was never had a chance to take one. And so that can still happen with even with 3 copies of the shock lands running around. So that's the only place where I think my evaluations change a bit, is once I have my shock lands, then I still prioritize fetches super highly, but I don't prioritize the second Steam Vents or the second Overgrown Tomb in my deck that highly.
Yeah, I think that's, I totally do the same. I think that just since you mentioned Prismatic Vista earlier, it is relevant that you're not going to have that many basics in your deck as you might in cubes with less fixing, and especially with Prismatic Vista, you sometimes just don't want to put in that one basic for a splash, so
yeah, like
that's
I said,
kind of where it stands out as being like a little bit of a weird card.
That's kind of how I think about splashes in this cube. It's like, splashes are colors you don't have any basics for, and so if that's true, then your Prismatic Vista is never fixing for your splash, unless you're willing to play a basic of that type. So that's something to keep in mind for sure. I think the other big impact of this mana base is just what it's like playing with 21 fetch lands in a 360 card cube, because it changes the relative power level of cards pretty dramatically in ways I think people don't always anticipate. The biggest impact is just that you can very reliably expect to have a land in the graveyard in most games, in most decks. Obviously, you still have to prioritize fetch lands to make this happen, but cards that care about that are going to be a lot better. Deathrite Shaman is really, really, really good here. I have it in like my top 10 cards in the entire cube. It's banned in Legacy, and it's banned in Legacy for a reason. And here you get to play it with some portion of that power level that it used to have in Legacy back when it was legal, because between you and your opponent, I would say 85% of games, one of you is going to put a fetch land into play on turn one with 21 running around. So it's going to very reliably be a mana dork, and then it has all of his other modes, obviously, as well. The other category of cards that gets a lot better, largely because of fetch lands, is Delve threats. You mentioned this earlier, Delve kind of being a way to cheat on mana. And yeah, I mean, Treasure Cruise is also banned in Legacy, and that card is in this cube, and it is very, very good because you will be putting a lot of cards in your graveyard, and a lot of them will be lands, just because you're going to have a lot of fetch lands in your mana base, generally speaking, especially if you prioritize them. There's other sort of longer tail effects to this, like obviously a card like Renin 6 is fantastic here because you can, if you prioritize them, end up with a lot of fetch lands in your deck, thus making Renin 6 live almost every time you draw it. You have more shuffle effects, so a card like Brainstorm is better here than it is in a cube with fewer shuffle effects. Landfall, there's not a lot of it in the cube, but your Lotus Cobras, like, they are better here, noticeably better here, especially when you draft around them and prioritize fetch lands, then you are used to playing with them in other cube environments that don't have this many fetch lands running around. So
yeah, Tireless Tracker and Titania also get pretty powerful.
For sure. I don't think of this cube thematically. I don't think of like, oh, I have a landfall theme, but there definitely are cards that have been selected and added to the cube because they interact with the density of fetch lands to form a sort of flavor, especially in green, to what the cube is doing. Life from Elome is in this cube. I have some more to say about that later, but if that card is good, it's good because there's a lot of fetch lands running around and you can reliably make it a draw two or three and never miss a land drop for the rest of the game. The last thing I'll say on mana bases, maybe you have something else to add, is that because of the density of fetch lands, I would take a picture of your deck before the game begins. I'm actually not even sure if you're allowed to reference a picture of your deck mid-match in like a competitive REL environment. Obviously, when we play casually, I'm happy to let my opponent reference their deck list, whether it's a photograph or whatever. Maybe you're not allowed to do that in competitive REL. I'm not sure. Ask a judge. But good news. You don't have to ask a judge because I ask a judge for you. At KubeCon, you will not be allowed to reference outside notes in the midst of a game in any format. You can reference notes in between games, but in between games you have access to your whole deck because it's in your hands, obviously, so you probably wouldn't need to reference a picture or notes at that point, so just remember what you can fetch, folks. Thank you to the KubeCon judging staff who answered this question of mine in the KubeCon Discord. Back to the show. Know how many fetchables you have of each type, because I've seen it happen plenty of times where someone plays their fetch land, goes to get something, and is like, oops, I actually don't have any left. That can happen here a lot more than in other cubes, because, yeah, if you have five fetch lands in your mana base, and then also, like, a creature land or two, now you're down to, like, having, you know, a handful of fetchables in each color, and you just might run out, and you don't want to be in that position where your fetch land whiffs. That feels pretty bad.
Yeah, there's also, you know, just sequencing decisions. Maybe you have an opening hand with two fetch lands. You need to make sure to fetch the right thing with your first fetch land so you don't end up not being able to get the color you needed on the turn you needed it. So I think that's a great call, just to pay a lot of attention to that. And like you said, that's a good reason why I really value the first of any shock land I want very, very highly, because it just
means I don't have to think about it.
I have the total flexibility.
Yes, that is true.
And if I don't, I've definitely put myself into awkward situations in terms of sequencing.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about just playing fetch lands in general, and everything that applies to a fetch land heavy meta, like in Modern or Legacy, applies here because there's a lot of fetch lands running around. So all that matters, and you should be thinking about it. You remind me of one more thing, which I guess I should say. I don't think it's almost ever correct to do the off-color fetch shock thing in this cube. I think that makes a lot of sense with original duels, right? And what I mean is, let's say you're an Izzet deck.
Name two colors.
You're an Izzet deck, and you use a Marsh Flats to fix for Izzet by also having a Plateau and Underground Sea, right? That works. That turns your Marsh Flats into a blue-red source, and it didn't cost you any other sources because the Plateau was already a red source. It could have been a mountain. The Underground Sea was already a blue source, could have just been a basic island. I don't think it's worth a life loss here to try and get tricky like that, personally. I could be wrong about that, but you're already losing a lot of life on your like regular bread and butter mana base. I think if you are replacing basics with non-basics that you only care about one of the colors that they produce just so you can turn on other fetches that are only going to be on if that non-basic is still left in your deck, I think it's a little too cute. Let's cut to the chase and just talk about the highest picks in this cube. I have my like top 10 here, which I partially consulted with some people in our playgroup that have drafted this cube a lot on because I don't want to have it be entirely biased by my perspective. I'm sure you have other ideas of what maybe are in the top 10, but I think it says a lot to say what are kind of the top-ish cards in the cube.
Even if it's not like the most important thing to fully understanding an environment, it's a good way to sort of set the tone and context and make sure you're not missing out on something obvious when you sit down and open your first pack.
There's a lot of information coded in these are the top 10 cards.
Exactly, yeah.
Even if actually knowing the top 10 is not the most important thing to know, it will, by proxy, communicate a lot of stuff to you. So, in no particular order, my top 10, as I sit here today, is Ragavan, Nimble Pilferer, Orcish Bowmasters, Snapcaster Mage, Uro, Titan of Nature's Wrath, Lurrus of the Dream Den, Renin 6, Deathrite Shaman, Kroxa, Titan of Death's Hunger, Urza's Saga, and Smuggler's Copter. This is a great time to tell you that
I was sure you were going to say Brainstorm, Consider, Opt.
I do love my cantrips.
Thought Scour.
This is a great time to tell you all that we do have a visual spoiler for every episode we record here at Lucky Paper, so you can go to luckypaper.co/podcast/167/cards.
Or there's a link in the notes that are already on the app where you're playing this podcast.
Yes, or you can check the link in the notes, and there'll be a visual spoiler of every card we're talking about in chronological order, so you can either follow along from the beginning or jump to where you see Ragavan, and that's what we're talking about right now. These are roughly my top 10, and these, I think, fall into a couple of categories. One category is just an insanely efficient card that is going to pretty much always be great, and that's where your like Ragavans and Orcish Bowmasters and Snapcaster Mages come in. Smuggler's Copter is also in this category for me. And the other category is just a really difficult to replace card, right? Like, yes, I think Lightning Bolt and Brainstorm, these are all great cards in this cube, but they're much more replaceable. If you don't get Lightning Bolt, you can get Shock, you can get Unholy Heat, you can get Seal of Fire. None of those are as good as Lightning Bolt, but they do a decent enough impression. What does an impression of Renin 6? Nothing. What does an impression of Lurrus? Nothing. These cards are singular, and they provide a ton of value, such that I would be thrilled to first pick any of these cards. I would take all of these over a fetch land. They're really hard for me to pass. I'll also be happy pick three to change my plan if I get past one of these cards and just start doing that instead, because these cards are good enough to justify that. Of note, of the cards I mentioned, five are gold, if you count Lurrus as gold. I mean, it's hybrid, but
it's the opposite of gold.
Sure, and that's by design. You know, I think gold cards should be some of the best cards in a cube because they are harder to cast. And so if you take your Renin 6 pack one, pick one, you're committing to being able to generate both green and red mana, and you get paid off for it. Renin 6 is gross here. I will also note that the existence of Orcish Bowmasters and Renin 6 in this list points to a fact which is very true, which is that there are a lot of really good things with one toughness in this cube, and dealing one damage is very powerful. Some of the best burn spells, I think, are your Forked Bolts, Arc Trails, stuff that does divided damage burn, because you can oftentimes get a clean, efficient 2-for-1 with those spells, which is really potent. Do you disagree with this list at all? Do any of these jump out at you as being wrong or off?
I don't disagree with any of those. I think there's a couple other things I would look at considering. Ancient Tomb is a card that I probably take way too highly and ended
up that
contributes to my 18 points of damage to myself for sure. But it is in this context where everything's kind of in this fair axis, it is kind of unique. Gaia's Cradle, we could also maybe put in that category. Skull Clamp stands out to me as a very powerful card. Obviously, it has been banned in every format it was considered for. Expressive Iteration is another very powerful gold card.
So yeah, all these cards are good, but as you'll notice, listener, none of them are doing anything quote-unquote broken, right? Like, they are doing something at a very good rate, but very fairly, right? Uro's great, but it is...
Yeah, Skull Clamp, notably not broken.
I actually think Skull Clamp is nowhere near as good here as people expect. One thing that comes from this environment with a lot of removal, with a really low curve, is I'm striving for small games by Sam Black's definition of small games, which is to say not that many resources in play on either side of the table. So like dumb examples of how that manifests itself is I'd much rather play a single target removal spell than a really good blocker like a Wall of Omens, right? Because if all things are equal and you're essentially going to be nullifying their card with one of your cards, my preference as a designer is for those cards to then be in the graveyard and out of play rather than still in play, complicating the board state and making it a little more difficult to make strategic decisions about what's going on. And for that reason, I have never seen anybody like go off with Skull Clamp in this cube and draw 6 or 8 cards in a turn. Have you ever seen that before?
I've tried my best.
Yeah. There's not a ton of token generators, and the ones that do exist require you to like do something else to generate tokens. I don't have planeswalkers that just uptick to spit out 1/1s. It's like Young Pyromancer and Clarion Spirit. You can make 1/1 tokens, but you gotta be working for it. So the like Skull Clamp to just draw a million cards thing is not always gonna happen. And if you're playing Skull Clamp fairly, in the sense you don't have a deck that's always gonna have an abundance of one toughest creatures to just throw into the Thresher, then you do have to draw 4 cards with it before you are card positive, because the Skull Clamp costs you a card, the first creature you sacrifice costs you a card, then you draw 2, then you're back to neutral, now you gotta sacrifice 1 more creature, then you're up 1 card. And again, hopefully the creatures you're sacrificing aren't worth entire cards, but here they often are. Here you often are just clamping one of the creatures you cast, one of the creature cards in your deck. So I have Skull Clamp in this next category here I have of contentious high picks, which I think some people would agree with you that Skull Clamp is broken, and I would not be surprised again to see a really great player sit down and make Skull Clamp look broken in this cube.
I mean, I think an even better example of just sort of how the context shifts is Umezawa's Jitte, which is
that's also on my list.
What's next on your list, which is a card that is still pretty good here, but not nearly as good as it probably looks.
It's funny because in a lot of ways that card is way better in a fair environment, because you want to be getting into combat, it kills creatures, it removes stuff from the board. Like, how good is GTA against your Storm opponent, your Reanimator opponent? Not that good. The trick here is that there is so much removal running around that it is a genuine liability to try and have a equipment that has to then hit to actually get value off of. 4 mana that's oftentimes broadcast is going to give your opponent a lot of times to interact and just stop you from getting that value. So, yeah, I think GTA is still a good card here. I don't think it's in the top 10. Obviously, I gave my top 10. It's not in there. And I think it's often underperforms people's expectations. People often look at it and think, well, this card must be broken here because there's a lot of cheap creatures running around and everybody's doing fair stuff. But a lot of that fair stuff is removing your cheap creatures. So something to think about. A couple other cards I think are contentious high picks that I think are worth discussing. I think Balance is one of the best cards in the cube, but a lot of good players disagree with me. And I have to give them credit and say that I don't often see it be broken. Like, I don't often see it doing things that seem fully unfair and like they're too efficient for its mana cost. I still think it's great. I've played it in some decks to great effect, but it's a build around. You really have to be committed to doing some sort of balance deck. You want to also be getting your Retrofitter Foundry and like other types of permanents in play that are not counted by balance. There's not a ton of planeswalkers running around this environment, but obviously having some of those really helps. I think that has the potential to be one of the best cards in your whole deck, but you got to be kind of committed to it to make it work. We mentioned Skull Clamp. We mentioned Umezawa's Jitte. Our playgroup right now is very high on Force of Will, which I love to see, honestly, because this is another card that you would think, in a fair environment, do I really want Force of Will? I'm 2-for-1-ing myself, right? One of the big values of Force of Will in Legacy is just the keep this in your hand, play your game as normal, and never lose to some card you can't beat, some combo thing, which is not happening here. It's never going to be like a one card you can't beat. But what Force of Will does allow you to do is play very aggressively and have huge swings in advantage in like the early turns of the game. So I think Force of Will protecting your Dreadhorde Arcanist that's about to draw you another card off that cantrip in your graveyard. So you're effectively going to like draw back out from being down cards from the Force of Will, or protecting your Young Pyromancer and making another token, right? Like, there's other ways, I think, to get back that value of 2-for-1-ing yourself, and the value you get for being able to tap out and play all these aggressive threats early in the game in a proactive deck and still holding up Force of Will, I think is quite valuable. Similarly, if you're a control deck, I still think it's quite good there because it allows you to counter the thing really early that you otherwise wouldn't have counterspell up for, and then lets you figure out how to like get that card advantage back later. So I don't think it's top 10 material, but right now our playgroup is very high on it, and I'm glad to see that because I really like playing a quote-unquote fair Force of Will. I think it's a really cool way to engage with that card. Dark Confidant is a contentious, very high pick in this cube. Obviously, the card is great. It also dies to a stiff wind. This is another card that I'm also happy to pitch a Force of Will to protect. This is going to draw me a lot of cards over the game, so if I have to save it for a turn to draw at least one card off of it, and maybe that was the last removal spell in their hand, it could be really good. There's a lot of, I think, that kind of gameplay in this cube where you are trying to stick and protect like your one good threat, because there's going to be a lot of trading of resources back and forth, a lot of one-for-one removal, and it's going to come down to who gets to stick their thing, who gets to keep their Young Pyromancer, who gets to keep their Dreadhorde Arcanist, who gets to keep their Dark Confidant, and that will then start to snowball out of control. The last ones I'll mention here are, I think the Delve spells are the best blue cards in the cube. If you asked me to like rank what I thought the best blue cards were in order, I would probably say Treasure Cruise, then Murktide Regent, maybe something like a Brainstorm sneaks in there before Dig Through Time, but honestly, probably not. I think those three Delve spells are probably the best blue spells in the entire cube, and that's again because of all of those fetch lands we talked about, and it's also because, as you alluded to, I run a lot of cantrips. I love cantrips. I love card selection. I love taking game actions. I love not losing because I am top decking badly, and so because of that, there's also a lot of cheap spells in the cube running around, so you can really fuel those Delve cards, and there's not a lot of ways in this cube to draw three cards, right? Like, because the cube is so efficient and low curving, you don't get to draw three cards for not a lot of mana almost ever. That's what makes Treasure Cruise kind of messed up. So Treasure Cruise, like, stands alone, I think, as like a very unique effect in the cube, in that it's so much raw card advantage, which has not come from a lot of other cards. Expressive Iteration is the next closest thing, I think, but quite a bit worse. So I put those in the contentious good cards too, because I've also heard good players say that they still think they're not that great, and I could be convinced, but I still take them very highly.
I mean, speaking of blue cards, though, Teferi Temporal Pilgrim really stands out as a card that just every time I see it in play in this environment, it seems to really, really dominate the game.
Yeah, five drops do tend to do that. There's a lot of times people die with that in their hand, though, or they play it.
I never see that.
That is how it goes. I'm very selective with my like 4 and 5 mana threats, and I think most of them should end the game if you're able to stick them. And Teferi's in that category, Titania's in that category, Nissa's in that category. Cards that are super powerful, very, very swingy. And so if you get to the point in the game where you get to resolve one of those spells and you're not way behind already such that you can't claw you back from behind, then yeah, they're quite good. I still wouldn't take Teferi that highly. I would take that like mid-pack if I knew I was going to be like a controlling blue deck. But I don't want that in my... This is a great example of, like, having a strategy, right? If I'm the, like, blue-red Delver-style tempo deck, I do not want a 5-mana spell under any circumstances. I would literally take Sleight of Hand over Teferi in that deck every single time. And that's the kind of decision that I think a player that's new to this cube or new to drafting cube in general would think would be crazy. Like, why would you take...
Wow, I feel really called out.
Would you play
Teferi?
No,
I don't take it that highly, but I feel like I'm too low on it currently.
Okay. Because, I mean, once you have Dragon's Rage Channeler, a Monastery Swift Spear, and maybe actual Delver, and a bunch of cheap spells, like, I just want anything to keep that cheap spell train going. Even the lowest tier cantrip in the entire cube over one of the only two and a very good blue Planeswalker in Teferi, but that's kind of what I mean by having a strategy when you're actually making your draft come together.
Can I ask you about three white cards before we move on?
Yeah, sure.
A couple of the things that do stand out to me as being somewhat unique are Esper Sentinel, Mother of Runes, and also Adeline. I feel like these cards just generate a lot of card advantage that really make a white aggressive deck kind of into the next tier.
I love all those cards. I think those are three of the best white cards. I agree. I wouldn't call those, for the most part, card advantage cards. Now, Adeline is one of the like biggest game cards I include, right? That's one of the only ways to generate like a ton of tokens and like, you know, really go off with Skull Clamp or whatever. So I think Adeline is kind of unique in that sense. I would intentionally not include four different cards like Adeline because I don't want every game to come down to people making tons of tokens in these giant board states. Esper Sentinel to me is just a like tempo hiccup. I'm almost never letting my opponent draw a card off Esper Sentinel. I'm just killing it a turn later and for one mana more than I wanted to, which is very annoying and can really disrupt the early turns of the game. But I would not in my head categorize that as card advantage. Mother of Runes definitely can be if you're just basically making all of your opponent's removal irrelevant, which does happen.
Either making it irrelevant or forcing them to use two of them.
Use two of them is actually what happens more in this cube, I think, because there is so much removal running around. I can't remember the last time somebody was like, well, there's Mother of Runes. I guess I can't win. It's just there's a Mother of Runes. I didn't have removal the one turn it was summoning sick, either because it was the first turn of the game or because I just was tapped out of it. And now I have to spend two on it, right? Or I have to, like, you know, figure some way to like wiggle out of it, which does cost you some cards. So yeah, those are all great cards. I think Giver of Runes is just as good as Mother of Runes here. Like, the fact that Mother of Runes can protect itself obviously makes it, I think, a more polarizing play pattern. But the extra toughness on Giver of Runes and the fact that it can give protection from colorless is also really relevant. I know those are definitely some of the better white cards, but they all strike me as a little more replaceable than some of the other stuff we talked about, right? Like, yes, is Mother of Runes better than Giver of Runes? Yeah. Is Esper Sentinel better than Thalia, Guardian of Thraben? Yeah, it is. But comparing that to like Ren and Six and the next thing does any kind of Ren and Six impression, it's like that kind of tells you why Ren and Six is so valuable.
Yeah,
in an environment
that's
like
fair.
This. also how good Renin 6 is against all those cards we just listed. It tells you how good Renin 6 is in a cube like this. Next up, I have some potential traps. And I'm saying traps in big scare quotes because I don't intend to put any actual traps in the cube. But there are definitely cards that are going to play way differently than I think some people would anticipate if you just glance at the list. The number one culprit here, I think, is Reanimate. I have the spell Reanimate. Single black mana sorcery, put a creature to play from any graveyard, lose life equal to its mana value. And I think reasonably so, most people think of that as a reanimation spell. And it is, but there's not a reanimator deck in this cube, which is to say there are very few big things you could actually find to cheat out that would matter. I mean, for example, things like Titania, maybe if you did literally go like fetch land, discard outlet, then get Titania back, then it's worth it. But if you don't have fetch land in your graveyard, the Titania is not that great to reanimate. I have Primeval Titan in this cube. It's probably the best thing you could actually reanimate if you somehow found a discard outlet to do so, but I don't include discard outlets as a like category of cards because there are no decks that want to discard as a matter of course because there is no reanimator deck here. So this has been in the cube for a couple years now. I didn't include it for a long time because I was worried people would see it in a pack and be like, screw it, I'm drafting a reanimator deck, and then totally bomb the draft because that deck does not exist. I finally added it, and for a while I would tell people at the beginning of the draft, that's the one thing I would say, is like, here's my cube, everyone have fun. Oh, by the way, Reanimate is in here for value. You're reanimating a 2-drop like pretty much every time. Do not try and draft Reanimator. So that's the number one thing I think could be a trap. I have never actually seen anybody go like Faithless Looting, Reanimate, Primeval Titan. It could happen. Maybe it'll happen at KubeCon, but I've never seen it happen in the like multiple years Reanimate's been in the queue. I've only ever seen it used to like get back something that could otherwise have been cast at that point of the game anyway.
Right. I mean, the limitation is we just don't have the redundancy of those effects. So
right. No redundancy of discard outlets, no redundancy of big threats.
Yeah, those are not going to individually support a different strategy.
Another one that I think some people might call a trap is Stoneforge Mystic. I think this card is great here. I think it's one of the best white cards, but there is no Cauldra, there is no Batterskull. You are not putting into play some, like, you're not using it as a way to cheat out a big threat, which is what Cauldra and Batterskull do. Because again, I don't want to cheat mana. What you are doing is going and getting your Lion Sash, your Glimmer Lens, your Grafted War Gear, your Umezawa's Jitte, a package of equipment, lots of which now has reconfigure or otherwise comes with creatures, so it's like your Glimmer Lens or whatever is also a creature. You're playing it as a like a value card and a toolbox card, not as a part of a two-card combo with Batterskull or Cauldra. All right, next up I have some cards that occupy this kind of space in my cube in my head of like sometimes cards, which is to say that a lot of times there will be a people that will sit down and draft the cube and there will be no home for any of these cards, right? Which I think is actually true of very few cards, right? Because I strive for flexible cards that are good in a lot of situations, but sometimes these cards just don't come together. And these are cards like Eidolon of the Great Revel, Embercleave, Life from the Loam, Collected Company, Exploration, Lethal Scheme. These cards have a very high ceiling if you can make them work. I think Embercleave can be great here, but it's not like there's always going to be a deck that is red and has enough creatures to justify an Embercleave. You can't just put it in your blue-red Delver deck. You can't just put it in your red-black attrition-y mid-range deck, right? You need to have a bunch of creatures. I think its best home is actually like a green-red stompy deck, but you can find your own home for it. But my point is that it won't always be there. Collected Company is another example of a card that I think can be excellent. You can definitely draft a deck in this cube with a high density of creatures and a high density of 3-drop creatures and just turn Collected Company into this huge bomb, but that doesn't always happen. Like, sometimes the... And again, it's 360 cards, so we're opening the same cards every time, but if someone wasn't prioritizing specifically the best 3-drop creatures in 2 or 2.5 colors, they'll just be kind of spread out throughout the pod such that Collected Company is not actually good in anybody's deck. So these are cards that you should look at with a critical lens and just ask yourself, am I actually this deck, or even though I'm a green creature deck, am I not actually the Collected Company deck? Or even though I have a few fetch lands, am I not actually the Life from the Loam deck? These are the kinds of cards I think that ask you to really build around them in a way that most cards in this cube don't. The last one I'll throw in there is one that I'm actually not entirely sure of. It's a relatively recent addition, which is Hogak. I put Hogak in. It's good for all the reasons Delve cards are good. I think it and Lethal Scheme both suffer from the you need to have two creatures in play for them to be really good, and ideally two black creatures. So the question is, like, can you actually make that happen in a cube where there's not a ton of black creatures? The creature colors are really, like, white and green, not as much black. And also, there's so much removal running around that if you just never get to stick a second creature, you never get to cast your Kogak. That's how Hogak works. Or your lethal scheme is going to be wildly overcosted and you're not going to get a lot of the benefit from it.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that... Has anybody actually really done the Hogak thing yet?
I don't think... I mean, we've only drafted this cube, I think, 3 times since Hogak was added a few months ago, and I don't think anyone's even put it in their deck yet. So, I don't know.
Maybe it's fine.
That's why I'm listing it in these cards, because there's not, like, a dedicated self-mill deck, right? Like, I think there are some cubes where Hogak is just always messed up, because if you have tons of ways to self-mill, and you've got all of your cards, like, Citrus Supplier and stuff like that, then Hogak is just great. That's not what's happening here. This is a, like, fair Hogak where you have to figure out some way to make it work.
I think the one other card that a lot of cube players would say is a trap is Temple Garden.
Hey, Green White is good in this cube.
Great. That's what I want to
hear. Green White's had a couple of good performances lately. You've just had some issues with Green White in the past. And
No. It's not about me.
I mean, I don't know. I'm definitely biased, but I do think, if I'm honest, I think red is probably the best color in this cube. I mean, you may notice that it had perhaps an outsized representation in what I think are among the best cards in the cube. And because there is so many cheap creatures running around, burn spells, which are already great, are even better in this cube than in normal circumstances. So if I had to pick a best color, I'd probably say it's red. But I do think every color, it can be great. I'm never surprised to see any particular color or color combination 3-0. And even like green-white decks, I think, can be very successful here, and green-black decks, like, they can totally work. I want to close on two more little lists of cards here, which are just often underrated cards. So cards that I think people that have not drafted the cube before might look at and think are not good, but are actually good. And then the opposite of that, cards that are often overrated. Underrated cards. Engineered Explosives. The curve is so low in this cube, and there is so much mana fixing running around. It's a great example of a card that will cause me to, you know, it'll be half of the reason I splash a third color will be Engineered Explosives. Give me Engineered Explosives, Prismatic Ending, and I will play off-color Shocklands all day. Well, half off-color Shocklands. I'm not a crazy person. This is so often a really effective board wipe, because, again, between 1 and 2 mana value, I think that accounts for something like 3/4 of the non-land cards in the cube. So you can blow up almost your opponent's entire board relatively efficiently with Engineered Explosives. At the very least, it is an extremely high-value sideboard card if you're not going to main deck it, but I'll try and main deck this in almost any deck I draft. Certainly if I'm anything resembling some kind of control deck, if I'm playing to the board a little less, I'm always jamming Engineered Explosives. But even if I'm not, it gives you so many great options in gameplay, where it's like, even if I'm going to lose a couple things, is it still worth blowing up all the 1-drops, because I'll come out way ahead if I do that. So that's a card that I think is just really good here. And also, it can be made to answer almost anything in the cube. I mean, you can blow up your Uros and Croxes with it. Like, it just does stuff. For very similar reasons, Spell Snare is a card that I often see people start on the sideboard. They're like, oh, Spell Snare, that's a sideboard card, because it only counters 2 mana value spells. There are so many 2 mana value spells, this is just an excellent counter spell. I will always jam Spell Snare. I honestly almost never will side it out. Like, I would really have to see something very specific from my opponent before I was going to be siding out Spell Snare, because this cube is, again, so efficient. You need a plan on turn 1 and turn 2. That plan is going to involve casting 2 mana spells. It's just, that's how it's going to work, no matter what your strategy is, whether you're control, mid-range, or aggro, you're going to have 2 drops. So I take Spell Snare pretty highly, and I always main deck it. I think it's great. I mentioned the Delve spells. I think they're all really good here, and people oftentimes underrate them because, again, like, I don't think Treasure Cruise is that good in the Magic Online Vintage Cube. I think it's much harder to fill your graveyard, and the reward for drawing 3 cards is not as high because there's lots of ways to draw 1 million cards in that cube because there's lots of individually broken cards. There's Ancestral Recall, so why would you care about Treasure Cruise? But those kinds of cards are really powerful here and stand kind of singularly alone for how efficient they are. And the last thing I'll say is often underrated is that cheap removal we talked about. Disfigure, Lava Dart, Forked Bolt. These cards are great. Like, I will often take a Disfigure over a, like, very powerful 3-mana win condition or 4-mana win condition because you just need a density of those kinds of removal spells. Is there anything else you think is often underrated by people?
I think, at least in our local playgroup, Sensei's Divining Top is a card that has grown in esteem, and a lot of people may be underrated at first. It seems like something that's just for setting up some of your miracles and things like that, but the fact that it just counts as, you know, drawing a card and casting a spell means it just turns on so many things, like your Ironcrag Pyromancers and your Ledger Shredders and all kinds of things like that. So I think that's a card that has really changed. My expectations around it have changed.
Yeah, I think that card is really good, and yeah, like you said, my favorite place to play that card in this cube is in a deck with a lot of spell cast triggers, like your Ledger Shredders and Monastery Mentors, and also with Urza's Saga. And then it's like, all right,
yes.
Now my land is going to turn on all of my spell cast trigger stuff for the rest of the whole game. It's so effective. So I do love that card here. I'm not sure that card is underrated as much as there's definitely a contingent of people that just refuse to play with it. They're like, I'm not going to make all of this decisions.
Oh, that's reasonable. I mean, that's how I feel a lot of times with Sylvan Library as well. It's just like, tonight, I don't have it in me.
Tonight's not a library night.
Something else that might be a little bit underrated just because it's not, you know, we talked about all these cards being iconic and known cards. Something that might not be is Moloch. This is from the Warhammer 40K set, so a lot of people might not have seen it, but it's just a very efficient, powerful creature.
So good. Yeah, I think the Commander product stuff is a good place to look for maybe underrated cards. Like, I still love Primordial Mist. I think that's probably broadly a little bit underrated, given that I
overrate it very highly.
Given that I mentioned all those caveats around a 5-mana spell, right? Like, not every blue deck is a Primordial Mist deck, but the ones that are, it's like so cool and so powerful. Yeah, I think all those Commander cards are potentially have high potential to be overlooked. All right, let's close on often overrated cards. I have a pretty short list here, but number one with a bullet, for sure, is Fractured Identity. This card has a huge reputation for being busted in the Magic Online Vintage Cube. I know there was a period where LSV would never pass it, like would take it over power sometimes because of how good it was. And again, it's because in that environment, everyone's doing broken stuff. And so the thing that not only does a broken thing for you, but stops your opponent's broken thing simultaneously is really powerful. In this cube, I'm not sure I've ever seen anybody Fracture Identity something that costs more than 4 mana, right? So you are going to be getting something that's a relative trinket in exchange for your Fracture Identity. It's still good. It's still a 2-for-1. It's still exile removal, but you got to be the kind of deck that is willing to wait till 5 mana to get a 2-for-1 and be willing to sometimes just Fracture Identity your opponent's 2-drop, because sometimes just having your own Tarmogoyf and getting rid of their Tarmogoyf is what you want to be doing. Tarmogoyf's another card that's actually often underrated. That's a good call out, actually, too. Just came up naturally in conversation, but Tarmogoyf is great here, and I think a lot of people think that card is, because it has fallen off in favor in Constructed so much, I think people maybe think that it's been outpaced by modern threats or something, but that's really just a factor of what the removal suites look like in Constructed metas, which is nowhere near as rigid in a cube environment, so Tarmogoyf is great. Anyway, Fractured Identity is fine. I will often not main deck Fractured Identity, even in a blue-white deck that is going to have access to enough mana to cast it. I consider it a sideboard card against opponents that are going kind of big. So take that with a grain of salt. For very similar reasons, Mystic Confluence, I think, is often overrated. I think this is probably the worst counterspell in the cube. It's a card that I want, again, only in some blue decks. I don't want Mystic Confluence in my more aggressive blue decks. If I have it on my controlling decks, I want it to be like one of the only expensive spells that I have. Like, I don't want to run Mystic Confluence alongside Fracture Identity, because if opening hand with both of those in it means I basically mull to 5 for the first 6 turns of the game, and I just can't afford to do that in this environment. Again, I still include it because I like it. I think it's cool, but not a super high pick, I would say.
It's funny that we just said a lot of the Commander cards are potentially underrated,
and then here are two that are overrated.
Overrated ones, but definitely we've seen a change in the sort of design philosophy of Commander focused cards as well.
And importantly, these are ones that have developed a reputation, right, in like the Magic Online cube, where like Moloch has not. I don't think it's on Magic Online, honestly, but if it was in the Magic Online cube, maybe it wouldn't be underrated. My last overrated card here is Swords to Plowshares, which is really kind of a stand-in for cards that are the best of a redundant effect. I actually feel like I have been reminded of why Swords of Plowshares is so good because of the Neoclassical cube, which is a very different environment where in that cube there are reanimator strategies, there are more unfair things you can be doing, and I've really felt the value of Swords of Plowshares as a like 1-mana answer everything and it's gone forever. It's exiled, you don't have to worry about it ever again. In this cube, Swords of Plowshares is still great. Don't get me wrong, it's not a bad card, but how much better is it than Flame Slash or than Fatal Push? Not that much better. Not enough better that I'm like windmill slamming an early Swords to Plowshares and being like, this is great. It's still just a 1-for-1 removal spell, and there are tons of 1-for-1 removal spells in this cube. So I think Swords to Plowshares fits in this category. I love Brainstorm. I'm not going to say Brainstorm's overrated, but it's the best cantrip in this cube, but that's still the best of a class of cards of which there are a lot of redundant examples of. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when you are drafting, is just I will always take the irreplaceable thing over the replaceable thing, assuming that my distribution of threats and answers and stuff is what I want it to be. What else do you think is overrated, Anthony? Did I miss anything?
Well, we did mention Jace the Mind Sculptor, which is obviously a very iconic card, but I don't think that's something I see people take very highly here.
No, I think that has actually kind of suffered a little bit of the Tarmogoyf fate, where it has fallen off so much of Constructed that I think people now are like, yeah, that card's not that great. And it's fine. I like it a lot, but it's not broken for sure. we're going a little long, but I'm going to insist that we end on a pack one, pick one, Anthony, because we spent the whole episode talking about this cube, and I just think we should close by putting all that knowledge to work and doing a pack one, pick one. All right, I'm going to read the pack, and then I'm going to see what Anthony has taken out of it. We've got Barbarian Ring, Stomping Ground, Cheeky House Mouse, Goblin Rabble Master, Treetop Village, Llanowar Elves, Territorial Kavu, Liliana the Last Hope, Dauntless Bodyguard, Steam Vents, Inquisition of Kozilek, Questing Druid, Restoration Angel, Mutavault, and Traverse the Ulvenwald. This is the first pack I pulled. I didn't curate it at all, and I think it's interesting that we have no fetch lands, which is kind of rare. Or is it actually... Would most packs have a fetch land? Yeah, statistically most would have a fetch land, because there's 21 fetch lands, and there's only 24 packs opened.
But some will have two fetch lands.
I'm saying on average, you'll mostly have a chance to take a fetch land. Right? Is that how that works? Math is hard. Anyway, there's no fetch lands, which would be like a bar that any other card would have to clear. There's a couple of iconic cards people will recognize from other powerful cubes. What do you want here, Anthony?
Why'd you have to give me a hard pack?
I just picked the first one at random. It doesn't contain any of my top 10.
Yeah, I mean, this pack doesn't have anything that really, really pulls
it's kind
me
of a bad pack.
Direction. I mean, Llanowar Elves is obviously very efficient if you want to play this sort of green ramp deck. I've struggled, honestly, with those kinds of decks in this environment, so that's not where I'm feeling today. Questing Druid is kind of interesting just for being a new card, and it has a lot of value. It's got a lot of potential, but I'm still a little bit skeptical of that as well. So I think I'm honestly between Liliana the Last Hope and Inquisition of Kozilek. I actually thought this was the other Liliana, so I'm now more excited about Liliana.
Yeah, Last Hope is better than Liliana of the Veil, for sure.
Yeah.
At least in this environment.
Choices.
I mean, it's funny, I could talk about this cube forever, which I guess makes sense, because there's only time we spend thinking about it, but like we haven't even talked about the ramp deck. I think the ramp stuff is still good, but it does not resemble the ramp deck you're used to seeing in the Magic Online cube. You're mostly ramping into three drops, and maybe four drops, right? You're playing them a turn early, and then you're hitting really hard and generating card advantage with them. You're not playing seven drops in your ramp deck. So I still think Llanowar Elves is quite good. Not a card I'm going to pack one, pick one personally, but definitely has its place in this cube.
All right, I'm taking Liliana. Done.
Cool. For me, this is a easy Inquisition of Kozilek.
Yeah,
I think you could argue that's actually the best discard spell in this cube, where most cubes would fall behind Thoughtseize. I think enough of the cube is three mana value below that Inquisition is maybe just better than Thoughtseize here. I mean, it takes everything in this pack, and this is a very representative pack in terms of the curve of the cube. And not having that life loss can really matter in a situation where you have all these fetches and shocks. So to me, that is like clear, like half tier above everything else in the cube. And then after that, I think Rabble Master, Llanowar Elves, Liliana are kind of all in the same tier. Maybe Questing Druid gets in there too. I still don't know what to think about that card. But I think those are all kind of in the same tier of like, yeah, they're good, but this is not a great pack. I would not be thrilled to open this pack if I were at KubeCon personally, but I would definitely take the Inquisition out of it. And that's actually another great example of, you know, this is not too far away from our Disfigure and 3 or 4 mana win condition pick, right? In Retail Limited, you're always taking the Planeswalker, right? The Planeswalker's great. Liliana is really good here, but I so badly want to have something to do on turn 1 or turn 2, and Inquisition's one of the best things I can do on the turn 1 or turn 2 of the game, no matter what deck I'm playing. Whereas Liliana, more committal, gotta be double black, and it's really good in some situations, but only kind of middling in others, and there's just going to be a lot of pressure put on my 3 mana and up slot that I'm going to start an Inquisition. And maybe wheel Liliana? Probably not, but it's not out of the question.
Probably not. I already took it.
No, yeah, definitely not if you take it. That's true. I'm sorry. Restoration Angel is in the pack. You cannot take that with Inquisition of Kozilek. Don't write in. Whew, man, I wanted this to be a short episode, and I've just gone and blabbered up this cube for too long. Anyway, that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Check out our print at luckypaper.co/shop if you're going to be at KubeCon, or if you have a friend that's going to be at KubeCon, and they're willing to bring that print back for you. And tell your friends that are going to KubeCon if they listen to the show that this print's available, because, you know, it's a small market we're trying to reach here. Only the, like, 400-some people that are going to KubeCon, but what I want is for anybody that would want one, we'll have a chance to get one before we close the sale. Because we do have to close the sale in like 2 weeks, which is before KubeCon starts, so we can get them all produced and packed up and stuff. I don't want to be at KubeCon and have someone be like, oh, I didn't know about this. I wish I had known. I would have gotten one, because I'll feel bad about that. So that's all I want. If you want one, you should have a chance to get one. Anyway.
And it looks cool.
It looks cool. We worked hard on it. It's actually funny how much cumulative work went into making this possible, right? Like, all of the organizers of KubeCon had to run the event. All of the designers of these cubes had to make all their cubes. Jet had to make the whole map logic. You had to build the whole map rendering technology. I made a poster. I also contributed. So it's just funny all the different stuff that had to happen to make this thing, make this dumb little print come to life.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And on that bombshell, that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. We'll see you next time, and we'll see some of you in Madison, Wisconsin in just 3 weeks when this episode comes out, Anthony. We did our countdown like for months leading up to KubeCon last year, and we've been like lacking, and I keep thinking it's like 2 months away, but it's so close.
Time is so difficult to get a handle on.
It's true. Anyway, all of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This show is produced by Anthony and I thinking really hard about magic cards and then speaking into microphones about it. Thank you for indulging me in a entirely too long discussion of my main cube, Anthony.
Of course. It was important. People need to know what they're getting into when they're drafting this cube.
I can't wait for Sam Black and Caleb Durward and Dom Harvey. Dom Harvey's actually drafted the cube before.
He played at Temple Garden and kicked my teeth in.
I still am mad at him for mana leaking me out of his green-white deck when I least expected it. It was like the only blue card I saw him playing in that entire draft, and it was in the finals. I went to like turn the corner, and I think it was maybe even game three, and I was like, I got him now. I'm going to play my big Planeswalker, and he was like, mana leak? And I'm like, what? you're not even playing blue. You can't mana leak.
What did you think the whatever it was, the Hallowed Fountain was there for?
He was playing Knight of the Realm Inquiry or something, and I was like,
that
maybe...
That doesn't explain it yet.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I thought there was... I don't know, okay? He got me with it. It felt bad.